Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me as always is my colleague and co-host, David Wondrich. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing okay. Yourself?
I am well. I feel like I'm being taken over by books in my house more than usual. You and I are no stranger to reading and writing books, obviously. And I don't know, it seems like it's become even more out of hand recently with, you know, ever more new drinks books to read, but also, you know, every time I feel like I've read, you know, all the vintage ones, suddenly I find out about dozens of other ones that I've never read, never heard of, and have to read. So it's just like a, I don't know, like a, you know, a river of books, it seems.
I look upon it as like, you know, the stacks of books that are everywhere I could see. I look upon that as adding insulation to the house.
So. Yes. Yes. I think that they make good insulation.
Yeah. So I'm well insulated right now. Very well insulated.
I'm sometimes worried that the piles may topple over us and hurt us like the Collier brothers, but you know, hopefully that's not our fate.
I hope not. And also of all the ways to go, you know, that one's not so bad.
That's true. It's true. Well, we have, you know, an interesting show today with two other folks who I think, you know, possibly might even love old drinks books more than us, which I know sounds hard to believe, but it is true. Our friend, Dr. Nicola Nice from Pomp and Whimsy Gin Liqueur. And also Lizzie Young, the antiquarian bookseller who used to be in Brooklyn, but is now in Newport, Rhode Island. Both of them, you know quite a bit about vintage drinks books and also about drinks books that, you know, a lot of other folks, you know, haven't read yet or haven't even heard of yet.
New places to look. I mean, that's, you know.
I'm excited and a little scared because I know I'm going to have to make some more room on the bookshelves or buy a new bookcase for these books, but you know, such is life. But I'm excited to hear about what they have to say and all the books that they recommend.
This should be fun.
Welcome, Nicola and Lizzie. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Dave and I are obviously huge fans of new and vintage cocktail books. I think we've been collecting and reading them for decades. You know, it seems like now they're super trendy. And
I remember when they were cheap.
Dave, I think certainly you probably have an even larger collection than I do of vintage books at this point.
Yeah, I do and I don't, because I had to stop collecting them with any seriousness about 10 years ago when they started to get just really expensive. Even after writing a book on Jerry Thomas, I still don't have a first edition of his cocktail book, for instance, because it was always just hovering right outside of my price range. And now it's up to, like, you know, something like $3,500, which seems like a lot of money to pay for a cocktail book, I have to say. So my collection slowed down some, but I'm always looking for new areas to move into, which is one of the things we could talk about. I know Nicola has done a bunch of looking into that, and I'm sure Lizzie has some good insights on places to look.
So, David, you do not have a first edition of Jerry Thomas, really?
Nope. I know, it's funny.
You have some of the other ones.
I have
ones,
his business card, for instance.
Right.
Wow.
Hand-drawn and everything, or at least photo-reproduced from one of his drawings, but I don't have his first edition.
Yeah, I have a second edition right now on hand. And that's going for like 2000. That's the
That's much rarer. The second edition is very rare. That I have because people didn't know what they had.
Because it's a paperback.
I have the one, I think it's what, the 1887 one, the one that's like was printed, the covers in red and some other ones. Yeah. And that
that's
one
the
is
the second edition. That's the one I have on hand now.
Well, okay, right. I think that's actually the third edition because there was a second edition in 1876 that this is getting very geeky. Had the same cover as that one.
Oh.
But the content was the same as the first edition plus this appendix of weird new drinks from New York, basically.
Oh, right.
And that one's almost impossible to find.
What our discussion, you know, points out is also that like there were many more copies of Jerry Thomas's book than the price would belie. Like it was mass produced. It wasn't like a, you know, some books, you know, there's a run of 50 books, right? You know, or 100 books and that's it. Where Jerry Thomas's book, you know, they were pumping it out for decades. It's almost never been out of print at this point. So there are all types of the Herbert Ashbury editions where he wrote a foreword, who also wrote the Kings of New York book, and all types of Jerry Thomas books. They still turn up in yard sales.
It was a bestseller.
But just like cookbooks and children's books, they get used. That's kind of the issue, is that the books that do get used, which is fantastic, of course, because we want to use our books, are the ones that suffer because they get, you know, things spilled on them and, you know, children pulling them apart or, you know, getting the dog, you know, whatever. Like, so that's why they become, you know, a lot of people just have their books in their shelf, but these are like working books.
Well, I have a copy of the Savoy Bartender's Guide from 1930 that my oldest friend, my friend Kenneth Goldsmith, I've known since I bought firecrackers from him when we were 14. his uncle was a rent collector in some unsavory neighborhoods of New York City back in the day, some pretty tough neighborhoods. He always carried a gun. But when he got home from collecting rents, he opened the Savoy book and made himself a cocktail.
Wow.
And this book is in terrible condition. But, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I mean, it's falling apart and it's marked every drink that he made. Like he checked off the list and went through it over the decades. The covers are off, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, for me, that's a valuable thing.
I have to say that one of the things I love about finding in books is the opposite of what people would think, but like handwritten notes, things that people leave in books, recipes and remedies written on the back of other things. And it just tells this whole story because it becomes like this more than the book.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually. I think that the books become more valuable to me the more insight I could get into who used them and how and why. Those kind of stories, as you were saying, David, are to me where the real value is, even if that doesn't translate into monetary value.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, but I think it's the difference between people who use the books and people who are just, you know, collecting them for investment. Mm. And if you're using the books, the more information you can get, the better. You know, the condition doesn't matter. What matters is the culture behind it.
Right.
Well, and I think the Savoy one is an interesting book too, because, you know, that's also one that has always been collectible because it's so beautiful. So people who loved, you know, Art Deco items, people who love design, you know, it was one of these things where, you know, that was something that was always prized and saved, which is fairly rare. And I think a lot of the attention goes to the Jerry Thomas's and the Savoy cocktail books, you know, but really there are a lot of, I mean, there are hundreds of other ones. So
let's talk
about
some of the things that people, that, you know, collectors haven't, been pouncing on quite so much.
Even though this will ultimately hurt Dave and I and our collecting ambitions, because everybody will now look for these books too, but we're willing to do it for the greater sacrifice, for exactly. the greater community. So yes. What are some of the ones, you know, that people have overlooked or don't even know exist that would be, you know, that have a really lot of information about cocktails and spirits?
I think the interest for me has always been less about who originally wrote about cocktails and more about who may have popularized them. And so mm-hmm. in my research, what I was really looking for was the places where if I was a woman 100 years ago or 150 years ago who was entertaining my household, where would I have found my recipes? Would I have looked to something like a bartender's guide, or would I have looked somewhere else? And I think that's where I really got led down this path of a treasure trove of cookery books, entertaining books, etiquette guides, and household management guides, where I found lots and lots of drink recipes with advice, not just on how to make beverages and the ingredients that go into them, but how to serve them, how to hold a toast, the order of events. And it's to me that sort of, as I said, that kind of cultural nuance that makes it really fascinating to me. I mean, I can Google how to make a specific drink, but how to really serve it is a different question.
This is part of the drinks world that has definitely been neglected, you know, for various reasons. I think collectors are such sharks that there are many reasons to collect books, and they would have jumped on these had they noticed or realized their importance. But they were indeed very widespread. The first drinks book, the first book with a recipe for punch, was Hannah Woolley's Queen Like Closet, the one book I would mm-hmm. give more than anything to have a copy of from 1670. You know, I mean, wow. That's really the beginning of everything there, because all the other mixed drinks kind of stem from punch,
right?
And that's where it made it on record, and it was a popular book.
Lizzie, is that one that you ever see in your shop, or is that?
Yeah, I've seen it on other people's in other people's booths at book fairs, which actually, this is the most beautiful thing. This is the only good thing about what's going on right now in the world, is I am actually duly doing this podcast and sitting in my virtual booth at the New York Book Fair.
There you go. You can be two places at once.
Yeah, I love it. Amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, I've seen, you know, a lot of British dealers, you know, have some of the really, you know, the ones that you can't get your hands on for some ridiculous prices. So, yeah.
I mean, these early women's cookbooks, that they had a lot of drink stuff in them. I know. And, you know, this was at a time when women were the bartenders in England.
Right. Weren't they that they were the tavern holders, right? I mean, they were the people who were owning and running these taverns.
There was a system where things were run on a kind of a family basis. Usually, if there was a male in the family, he would be the tavern holder, and the daughters would be the bartenders, and the sort of alternate tavern holder would be the wife in the family, and it seemed to work like that. But often there was no male, in which case it would be the senior woman in the family would be the tavern holder, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the landlord. But the actual mixing of drinks was usually done by young women, and that was perfectly normal. And there are all kinds of pictures of women sitting behind the bar with the punch bowls stacked around them, you know, waiting to fill them and serve them out. And you go to the British Museum and you can find them in their print collection. And it's always very, very cool. You know, it's like, this is a world that we're so used to the American model, where the men kind of threw their elbows in and edged everybody aside. But that was not the universal model.
There was a writer in the early 1800s who went by the pseudonym Mistress Margaret Dodds. Yes. And that name was actually taken from a local landlady. So her real name was Isabel Johnson. But her book that she published in 1826 the Cook and Housewife's Manual, has so many recipes for not just making drinks, but actually distilling and brewing as well. So it's interesting sort of crossover there with what you're saying.
I used some of her recipes in my punch book. That was an important book and exceptionally detailed, as I recall.
And I think you're right. I mean, I think that it's not just cocktails, but it's also like this idea of like how to stock your pantry, right? And it's making different, you know, compounding spirits, some distillation, brewing information, and, you know, even how to, what to look for in buying spirits. So it's interesting. I mean, it's usually, you know, one chapter among many chapters of advice on how to butcher animals or, you know, jam or, you know, it is very detailed and it's very, you know, advice driven. So, I mean, it kind of gives a lot of insight into both the drink and also how to produce spirits, which we also see in some of the early cocktail books where people are making, you know, whiskey in quotes, you know, by, you know, coloring and flavoring neutral spirits. So it definitely gives you an insight into sort of the larger liquor world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually looking right now. I've got a copy of Hannah Glass's The Art of Cookery, Made Plain and Easy, 1760. And there's chapter 20, distilling, to distill walnut water, to make black cherry water, to distill red rosebuds. Ooh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was still that medicinal aspect to spirits. Again, you know, this is before even aspirin. So what did you have that was really effective that doctors had? I mean, there wasn't much for treating anything that would make you feel better. Alcohol and opium were the main ones, I guess.
Right.
Some of my favorite manuscripts that I come across, the handwritten ones, they are produced do-si-do, which means they're written one side and then you turn the book over and it goes the other way on the other side. And then there's recipes one way and remedies the other.
You know, that was considered within the women's realm of competency and so strongly, other than, you know, professional doctors that hardly anybody ever consulted because they were expensive and really didn't do shit.
They were more like the butchers, right? Like the doctors were considered really more somebody who could come in and just, you know, cut somebody open, right?
But we do see some medicinal guides from the same period, right? Like, you know, that doctors write that do also have chapters on cocktails and spirits too, which is interesting, where, you know, like, you know, kind of almost, you know, like a Dr. Spock, but for like the 1700s, which includes a lot of medicinal cocktails, which sound funny today, but Dave, you're right. I mean, that was cutting edge science.
I come across a lot of pharmacists' manuscripts from like, you know, the 18th century, 19th century. And there are a lot of that as well, besides, you know, other compounds, but there is a lot.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
That as well.
You get things like a common recipe with Stoughton's bitters, which was supposedly for digestion, but even Stoughton, while he was alive, Richard Stoughton, the London apothecary who basically invented bitters, he advertised his elixir, which everybody else called bitters, but he advertised this stuff as being of a pleasant, bitterish taste. So it was, you know, it was sold as much on taste as it was on efficacy. It was like, this stuff will settle your stomach, but it also tastes decent. So why not?
Right. So I've seen that also with a lot of the liqueurs that women used to make in the home as well. For example, a blackberry cordial is great in a Kir Royale. It's also apparently a very good remedy for diarrhea. So dual purpose.
Good to know.
Well, you know what? I think it's funny. You collect American bartenders' guides, at least if one does. You see these medicinal recipes coming out of things like Mrs. Beaton, you know, out of women's home guides, and migrating into American bartenders' guides. Things like blackberry cordial and cough remedies and so on and so forth. It's very interesting to see that, you know, it becomes professionalized and, you know, wrapped in this mantle of this is only for professionals, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But these women like Eliza Acton and Isabella Beaton were huge stars of their day. Mm-hmm. Millions of copies of their books sold worldwide. They stayed in print for over a century. Even though Isabella died only a few years after she published the Book of Household Management.
Yeah. I have a question. When did the whole temperance thing happen so that these things started falling away from women's books? There is a point, right, where we don't see that anymore.
You can already see that in the mid-19th century, especially in the English books, where they're still giving drink recipes, but the alcohol content seems to be getting smaller and smaller.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Like, you know, the books like Hannah Glass, I mean, those are full alcohol punches, right, et cetera. And even Mrs. Beaton's kind of pulling some of the booze out of her recipes, I've noticed, when you compare them to some of the others. And, you know, they agree that was one of the most influential books there was. Mm-hmm. And then is now outsold the Bartender's Guide by a huge margin.
Yeah, well, I would argue that if you look at the collection of women's writings through the years, one of the common themes actually is responsible drinking. It's something that women talk about a lot. And, you know, the first person to publish a completely dry cocktail book in 1920 was Bertha Stockbridge. So, you know, a woman was one of the first people to address the new entertaining dilemmas that came about as a result of prohibition. And so I think that that's something, again, that's quite distinct about the way women think about cocktail recipes in serving them. And, you know, obviously what goes with that is responsibility as the hostess.
It's almost like a twin narrative where you have the rise of cocktails and also the rise of the temperance movement, both growing, you know, on separate tracks. And, you know, most people in America, I think that, you know, the temperance movement starts, you know, in 1900, right? But it goes back much further, even in Europe. And both of these, you know, kind of major storylines grow on their own and have different influence. But I mean, I would argue also that, like, at the turn of the century, when the medical community starts to weigh in on, like, whether or not some of these bitters or tinctures or other, you know, medicinal concoctions actually work. And you have laws passed, at least in America, where, you know, disavowing some of this, you know, what was thought as real science or medicine, you know, it becomes more recreational. We definitely see a huge cleaving. And in the UK, you know, all the, you know, top medical journals follow, you know, there's the Royal Commission on Spirits. You know, there are articles about it in all of the top medical journals because doctors want to know whether or not what they're prescribing is actually legitimate or if it's, you know, rot gut that's being called cognac or brandy or whiskey.
Another place I've been finding some interesting information is some of these old trade catalogs from liquor dealers. And then you can I mean, it's so cool to see, you know, local stuff that obviously, you know, just lasted a couple of years. But that's also a fun way to find out like what people were making and distilling, you know, locally.
I always found it was very interesting to see the different grades of a spirit that companies were selling, from absolute fake crap to like really, you know, luxury, like guaranteed, you know, we aged these barrels ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. It was, but you had to trust the company, which you look at some of the stuff they're selling, and it was like, looking at that, why would I trust your top of the line stuff? You know, because that stuff looks pretty dishonest.
Lizzie, are there books that you're beginning to see people like have interest in the drinks world that previously like, you know, weren't really sought after or valuable?
Well, I mean, I just think that I do think that a lot of people are now going because they're going towards things that are like handwritten. So first account of something, again, you know, things are written on the back of things. So they have a double meaning. So you can have like a German immigrant who has brought her cookbook from Germany to the US, and she has, you know, a recipe written on the back of some important letter. So, I mean, that's why, you know, you never take anything out of a book, but, so all those little pieces of paper, but so, especially, you know, I deal with universities a lot, and they're really looking for like the firsthand, account of what somebody is doing, how much water they're using, like, because then you can tell, you know, what it took to make these recipes and remedies. They can kind of figure out, like, you know, where the water source was and what it took to, you know, create this kind of household. So that's also an interesting way of looking at it.
So I should go and write in all my books then.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, good, because I already do. So.
Do you think that like things like, you know, I love seeing when somebody has put in a book plate, you know, from like, you know, 100, their own book plate, you know, mm-hmm. how people would have their own library and would stick it in the beginning. Like, is that particularly sought after by collectors, or is that something that people don't want to see, or?
Oh, absolutely. And also, you know, some of these people who were making the book plates were just incredible artists. I kind of look at it a little bit, almost like tattoo artists, you know, in the same way. It brings this whole other thing to the book. So I love seeing that stuff.
I used to years ago, and then I had a stamp, and then I just gave up. You know, I have too many books. It just it got
yes,
to the
mine
point
are all
that
full
I was
of
just
post-it
like,
notes.
You know, but I do take extensive notes.
Don't give up.
Being a good academic, I do it with a mechanical pencil. But I definitely write in any of my books that I use. I make my own little index in the back that sometimes I remember to consult.
It is a kind of an aha moment when you realize that you're allowed to do, it's almost like as a child, you were told not to write in books. And then I had this moment where I was like, wait a minute, because I was doing the post-it notes too. And then I was like, wait a second, this is my book.
A number of years ago, William Grimes, who wrote, you know, this fantastic book on cocktails, but then he got into other things. And he lived in a small Manhattan apartment. So he gave away his drink books. And he gave me some of them. And I was shocked when I opened them to find all these notes in ballpoint pen. And, you know, he was a, like me, a comp lit PhD. And I expected him to be, you know, a good, obedient, you make all your notes in pencil. But the boldness and confidence of that just shook me to the core.
I would never, I could never.
No, me neither. I admired it, I have to say.
From what I remember, Gary Regan, our long, our beloved colleague, colleague, he got the rest of the books.
Mr. Grimes split them between us, which was extremely kind of him. I mean, there were some rare books in there and some old books, and it was, you know, extremely, extremely useful. So that was a kindness.
Nicola, do you want to talk about some of your recent like finds and ones that you've recently come across that have become helpful?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I was really curious about when I was doing my research was the transition from when women were writing these sort of household guides and cooking guides. And, you know, it always kind of felt like the recipes were probably, mm-hmm. you know, a few years behind what was maybe happening inside bars, right? And what was being published in cocktail books. So I was always looking for what is the first example I can find of, you know, what we might describe as bar recipes in a book authored by a woman. And I don't know if the one I found is the first one, and perhaps David, you will know, but I believe that it was in the Consolidated Library of Household Cooking mm-hmm. in volume 5, which was a volume on, it was a housekeeping volume by Christine Herrick and Marion Harland, who were a mother-daughter duo. Their last book was on beverages, and that was published in 1904. So that one is really interesting to me. There were a couple of other books that were also published that year that are exclusively drinks books written by women. But this was the first one I could find where you could really recognize bar style recipes in one of these books. Curious, David, if you've found anything that is that. Earlier than that.
Not earlier, but one that's explicitly marketed to bar book type customers is The Bachelor's Cupboard. Do you know that one? By A. Lyman Phillips, where it turns out A stands for Amy. And this was published in Boston, I believe, in 1906. So a little bit later, but it's full of cocktail recipes.
Oh, great. I don't have that one.
And it's very much a book for sporting gentlemen. That's how it's, you know, I think the drinks recipes were a way of getting people into it. But she also teaches like basic bachelor cooking, which is important and useful, you know, especially I think of some of these poor bastards and what they were feeding themselves.
Yeah,
it's terrifying.
And that becomes its own big kind of area of books too, where we see like in America, like in the middle of like the 40s, 50s, 60s, all of these books that are similar to the books that we were talking about, but now aimed at men and bachelors. And, you know, obviously Esquire mm-hmm. publishes a number of them with kind of like this idea of like, to be the well-rounded, you know, gentleman, you need to know how to make drinks, you know how to grill, you need to know how to play like poker, you know, all these skill sets, and you get all these interesting books where it's kind of a lot of the same information, but it's now repackaged for a different audience.
Yeah. The whole chafing dish cooking. That is just, I mean, what they got done on a chafing dish is pretty,
I think that's
amazing.
Amy Phillips's book is heavy on the chafing dish, because you couldn't expect these guys to, like, you know, operate a stove or anything. That was beyond male capability.
God forbid. and even some of the early James Beard books too, it's interesting that he kind of grows out of that area of books too into sort of full-on cookbooks, from the kind of like bachelor cookbook and cocktail hour, you know, drinks. So I think it's fascinating how drinks books kind of, or the drink content kind of morphs over time with changes in culture and society, and who's making the drinks and who's buying the alcohol and making it.
The other place I'm finding interesting recipes, and like I'd love to get the, you know, the earliest of all, but like some menus. So like they actually mm-hmm. some old like restaurant menus, they also have in the margins, you know, a drink recipe, and sometimes the, you know, the name of the cocktail is different from what you would expect these days. But that's also a great place, because as I'm realizing now, I'm going, you know, finally going out to some restaurants right now, you know, of course outdoors, of course, but like, you know, they don't hand you menus anymore. So you're getting that, you know, that whatever you call it, you have to do it on your
phone. QR code. Yeah.
The QR code. And then I'm sitting here going, wow, I have hundreds and thousands of menus in my collection here that I need to catalog because, oh, they've become more important. they're not making them anymore.
It's so sad.
Absolutely. I
have a bin of cocktail menus from great cocktail bars around the world. And that collection is basically finished, I guess, But I collect menus as well. And you get little booklets that bars used to give out with their recipe. And those are, I wish bars would do that still. That's a great way of, giving your customers something extra. But I collect ones having to do with tequila for some reason. And I have a nice little stack of Mexican cocktail recipes and cocktail menus from the 1930s and 40s and 50s that's my favorite little collection, I think.
They're also so visually exciting, like some of the like Seagram's and Taylor's and Myers, and they all just put out these fabulous pamphlets. I love that stuff.
You never know what you're going to find, because that stuff is in no bibliography. It's nobody knows what was made, and you come up with the most fantastic things sometimes. Things that just like took me completely by surprise. I got a bar book from a bar in Panama that was a sailor's bar in the 1930s that has drinks named after all the various U.S. Navy squadrons that were stationed there.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of thing is just amazing. It's like it's never been cataloged. There's all kinds of stuff like that.
Well, thank you both for coming on and talking cocktail books. Hopefully, we'll keep finding cool stuff. Hopefully, in a couple hundred years, people will be reading the books that we're writing today and discussing
them. I have both of them on my desk right now.
Amazing.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thank you. And I'm just going to say, my credit card is looking at me very sadly right now. There's clearly some things that are missing.
Well, same.
I was thinking the same thing.
Nicola, you've given me all kinds of things to think about and look for. So I'm very both pleased and a little bit dismayed about that. hopefully we can have this conversation again in a while and see what's changed and see what's new in the world of cocktail books, because this is something that's always interesting, I think.
Yeah, I would love that.
Come on back. Cheers.
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 Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly always.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.